That particular song fell into a certain social context. The country had veered to the right, and the Republicans at the time were basically attempting to co-opt anything American.
America's future rests in 1,000 dreams inside your hearts. It rests in the message of hope in songs of a man so many young Americans admire, New Jersey's own Bruce Springsteen.
Born in the USA was a song of rebellion. When I wrote that song, I said, hey, no, it's like that flag, that's mine too. And that experience is not the same experience that you're talking about and that's being put forth as the American experience. You know, those values aren't particularly the same value.
Is there anybody alive out there? What
Hey everybody, I'm Lee McCormick. Welcome to Tramps Like Us, a Bruce Springsteen podcast, episode 94, Born in the USA, album review, side one. So I got a four-part series on this album, Born in the USA, for you. We're going to kick it off with a two-part roundtable album review discussion. This episode will feature side one, and side two will follow next. To help me break down the record, I've invited Joe Royland from the Sit and Spin with Joe show, BJ Cramp from the Rock and or Roll podcast, and making his debut on the Tramps Like Us podcast, John Lamoureux from the Hustle podcast. This was a super fun discussion. I thank Joe, BJ, and John for joining me and lending their valued opinions, and I thank you for downloading and listening via the website trampslikeuspod.com, iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast platform. Stay in touch with us via the website and the Facebook group page, Tramps Like Us, a Bruce Springsteen podcast. Released 36 years ago this month, Born in the USA is Springsteen's biggest selling record, his most popular, and the album of his that made me a devoted fan. I first owned the cassette, then I got the record, then the CD. It was actually the first CD ever produced in America. That's a cool little bit of trivia. Quite appropriate, I think, given the title, you know. I've since collected all the 7-inch singles, all the 12-inch singles, the 180-gram vinyl reissue from a few years ago. And last year I was in Singapore and I found a Japanese vinyl pressing. And with the Obi and the Japanese booklet, that one sounds really, really good. Needless to say, I really dig this record.
I don't know, I guess the last couple of records I've been mainly trying to write as realistically as possible, you know. And your perspective changes as you get older. You know, we're born to run when I was 25, I'm almost 35 now. And, you know, hopefully you become a better writer. When I was writing the Born to Run album, I was kind of interested in writing like bigger than life, you know, bigger than life size, real, very romantic and heroic, I guess. And lately, I guess mainly I've just tried to scale it down to what I feel life size is, you know. My concept of, I think, what heroicness has changed quite a bit since those days. It's like my sister, she got married when she was really young. She was like, I think 17 or 18, you know. And that was really hard. I had a real hard time. My brother-in-law was a construction worker, and then they stopped building the buildings, you know, when we had the recession. And they just went through a lot of real hard times, you know. They had a couple of kids. And you know, it's like I see them now, and it's great. You know, they really, they're like 12th, 13th anniversary or something, you know, and they're just doing real good, and the kids grew up, and they're real great, you know, great kids. And, you know, that was hard to do. That was something that was really hard to do, you know. And I guess if I had any heroes now, I'd be like, you know, like them you know, people that keep the world turning around a little bit, you know.
All right, so we're going to take down Born in the USA, do an album review for this epic record. So I had to get an epic panel of podcasters to join me on this one. So back again is BJ Cramp from the Rock and Roll Podcast. How you doing, buddy?
Hello, hello.
All right, we got Joe Royland from the Sit and Spin with Joe show. What's happening, Joe?
Hey, guys. Hey there, how there, everybody.
All right, and making his first appearance on Tramps Like Us, I'm excited to welcome John Lamoureux from the Hustle Podcast. What do you say, John?
Hey, everybody. Thanks. This is an honor.
All right, yeah. So, yeah, thanks, you guys, for joining me for this. Just let me give a spoiler alert right away. This is my favorite Bruce Springsteen record. So, yeah, this means a lot to me. So we're doing a whole month of podcasts focusing on this record, and we're going to kick it off with a two-parter on this album, doing an album review, right? So just before we kind of get into the record specifically and, you know, break it down track by track and all that stuff, let's just kind of go around and talk about when we first discovered the record. Let's start with BJ. When did you first become aware of Born in the USA?
Well, I liked it when it was new, but who didn't? You know, I was 10, 11 years old when this was huge. So, but at that time, I didn't own any music. My parents didn't buy records either. So my exposure to this was just MTV and the radio and the entire culture, I guess. So,
yeah,
but yeah,
so huge, right? Yeah.
I remember I was a fan of this when it was new.
Right, right. How about you, Joe? When did you first become aware of this record?
Okay, now this is where I'm going to make myself the very old guy in the room. we were talking about this before the show, but I have very specific memories of this album because this album came out the week I graduated from high school.
Whoa!
And nice. I clearly remember, like, a bunch of my friends and I, like five or six of us, after we got out of marching practice, we all knew this record was coming out. We all drove over to the local music land. And I bought it on vinyl, and two of my other friends bought it on tape. We then spent the next hour or two driving around listening to it. And then, like, it was either that same night or the next night that we had, like, a pit party with, like, all the seniors, and that was the soundtrack to that pit party. We were playing the album. So I have, like, lots of, like, memories just tied into that period of time specifically.
That sounds like so much fun, man. You're, like, what, 17, 18 years old?
18, yeah.
18, wow, that's so awesome. Summer 84.
Yeah.
How about you, John?
Yeah, I'm the same age as BJ. So same thing. I turned 11 in the summer of 84. And this was a part of, I think I've mentioned this before on my show or others, that I'm kind of bummed because my memory of my first record that I ever bought is actually a Columbia House, like 13 for a dime or whatever it was thing. And this was included in that, as was like Billy Joel, Incident Man, Huey Lewis and the News Sports, David Bowie, Let's Dance, those kinds of hallmark albums of the era. And I remember falling deeply in love with Courtney Cox. Deeply.
Oh, yeah.
And
I think we all did.
Yeah. I still love her, but she, anyway. So, yeah.
And then
I mean,
she
I was
on Family Ties. Right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Oh, my gosh. Yes. And a bunch of other things, bunch of other weird things that didn't take off. But anyway, I loved her, and I love this song. And just like BJ, I mean, you know, it's ever present. There's what, six or seven singles off of this album?
Seven.
So it didn't go away for years.
Yeah.
No.
Quite impressive.
This album was comparable to Thriller, the way it was just, you know,
more so
everywhere.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Well, my story, I probably told it a few times on this podcast, and like I said, this is my favorite Springsteen record, and it's because this is the first record Bruce released when I was sort of a Springsteen fan, and this is the first record that felt like my own Springsteen record. And you know, I was 10 years old, summer of 84, and you know, summer of 84, as much as it was probably so much fun for you, Joe. It was so much fun for me, being a 10-year-old kid and just being into wrestling and G.I. Joe figures and Indiana Jones, right? And Born in the USA was out there, and it was just like the summertime and, you know, cut grass and cherry Kool-Aid, right? And it was just so much fun. And watching, seeing these videos for the first time too, right? All these videos, which were so, like, the first time Springsteen is doing, you know, a video. Like, he put out Atlantic City as a video, but that was just scenery and he wasn't in it. But here he's released five incredible videos that were just in rotation for that year. So, yeah, I just love this record. It was a big one. And I first got it on cassette, I think, and then, you know, shortly after I found it on vinyl. I had to have both. And it was really cool, yeah. I think it's a great record. I think it's, you know, he consciously was trying to make a different move after Nebraska. Right, the old story about, you know, Springsteen doesn't want to make the same record twice, so he'll take these left turns, and going from the river, kind of exhausting all of his kind of bar band, kind of party music, as well as some of these country things that he's, you know, absorbing that, and then going from that to Nebraska, where he's breaking it down even more and just a solo acoustic kind of thing, and how he's shaping these songs, and you know, how his songwriting evolves, and how he's going to put this next record together. Right, which became sort of a pop album, which was, you know, intentionally he wanted to make it accessible to all ages, all demographics. At the same time, you know, I think it captures, you know, a lot of the anger and bitterness of Reagan era America.
Yeah. Yeah. It was the perfect album for its time. You know, it came along, like you said, with all those videos at like the perfect time. The MTV just exploded into houses everywhere. And like, you know, like you said, it was the album for that time. Like, much in the same way that Thriller was kind of an album, or even like Huey Lewis and the News Sports, it's not only is it one of his classic albums, but it's just one of the classic albums, not just of the 80s, but of ever.
Yeah.
You know, and like you were saying too, I agree that I also had in my notes that this was the first time you truly embraced pop music on a scale he'd never done before. There may be a song here or there, but like he went all in with this record and it paid off.
Yeah, bringing the keyboards with him and, you know, trying to capture that MTV generation. And, you know, he kind of became a sex symbol too. Like, you don't think of Springsteen as being like a sexy guy in 1980, but like around 84, all of a sudden, like, he's a good looking guy, right?
I guess a really interesting question would be how successful would this album have been without MTV?
That's true, yeah.
Because MTV, this was right when MTV was reinventing the music industry and the culture, basically. And right. So this album was just, you know, MTV is responsible for, God, what percentage of the record sales on this thing?
I know. Yeah.
75-80% probably. So
yeah, as well as all the radio airplay as well, right? Like, this song was on every radio station, like AM stations, rock stations, like, you know, easy listening stations would play I'm on Fire and Dancing in the Dark, you know?
And like you were saying, it wasn't just for, like, the better part of 1980, like half of 1984, but all of 1985 too. It was the top selling album of all 1985.
Exactly.
So half a year after it came out, it was still the biggest selling record that there was.
Yeah.
You know, that's impressive.
Seven top 10 singles, right? I mean, that's insane. So
you can't even do that anymore.
No.
The record was officially released June 4th, 1984. Okay, it debuted at number 9. 2 weeks later, it hit number 1, where it stayed for 7 weeks. And it actually lasted on the charts for 143 weeks.
Gosh.
So,
wow.
Yeah. So all of it was recorded between January 82 and March 84 in New York City at the Power Station Hit Factory Studios. And like I said, that's a good solid 2 year period where he's working on this record. He didn't tour Nebraska, so he really had time to craft this record and put it together and try to evolve his songwriting that he was doing around Nebraska and kind of shape it to more of a, you know, a pop rock sensibility. Right? Record was produced by Bruce, Chuck Plotkin, John Lando, and Steve Van Zandt. Both all those guys get a co-production credit on you know, the odd song here and there. Released on Columbia Records, obviously. Joe, you mentioned, it was the best-selling album of '85. And as of 2012, has sold 30 million copies, you know, making it his biggest selling record to date. Before we get into the tunes here, let's talk about that album cover. Do you love it? Do you hate it? Like, it is very iconic, but it's the guy's ass, right? So
Springsteen was never so good at album covers.
Yeah.
Picture, Nebraska's a good album cover.
Photo was taken by Annie Leibovitz, and I guess he talked about the cover saying that all the pictures of his ass look better than the ones of his face, right?
Yeah, that's just, yeah. Well, and what was, I read something where some people were saying it looked like he was urinating on the flag.
Yeah, that's just
okay.
That's
kind of silly. Yeah. But I mean,
I never thought of it as a picture of his butt, though.
True.
It's not as
cropped in as like a Sticky Fingers or a Too Fast for Love kind of thing. Because you get right. Half of his back, and you get kind of to the knee, and you get an arm hanging there, right?
So. Yeah. It never, I mean, if that's never been the dominant takeaway from that. It's like, oh, there's Bruce's butt. That's not really how I see it. But I mean, if you wanted to be, you know, cynical about it or whatever, that's kind of what it is. But it's an iconic photograph either way.
Yeah, striking. You get the red, white, and blue, right, with the red, white stripes, and you get the blue jeans and, you know, the red baseball hat, and his pocket was great too. And, you know, you see that little, there's that little tear in his jean pocket where it looks like his wallet's busting through. I'm like, I wonder if that's where he kept the Nebraska cassette tape, right? remember he had that cassette tape in his back pocket that he was trying to, like, I can't beat the demo. Maybe that's the pair of jeans where that cassette tape was packaged.
Right? That tape wasn't even in a case, probably.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just the loose cassette. He's sitting on it in the car.
Yeah. And great packaging, too. You get a cool inner sleeve where you get, like a cool shot of Bruce in blue jeans and a white T-shirt. And I always remember loving his biker boots. Like, he had these cool biker boots. I was like, oh, I need some of those, right? And then the other side's got pictures of the band, you know, all looking circa 1984. And there's a picture of Bruce, which I find kind of cool. You know, his little photo there on the inner sleeve. He's doing, like, the Michael Jackson, like, up on his tippy toes kind of thing. And he's, like, pulling his jacket collar out. So that's like a hot Michael Jackson dance move. So I'm wondering if that was intentional, you know?
Nice.
Yeah. And as well, we also get an extra insert with the lyrics, right? The black and white lyrics of these 12 great songs. So great package. And, you know, when I was 10 years old, I just would play this record and stare at it for hours and read the liner notes and all the names and the credits. And, you know, I love this record. One of my favorites. Mm-hmm. All right, so are we ready? Let's kick it off with a track by track, right? Dropping the Needle on side one, and we get the title track, which was also the third single, released October 30th, 1984, went to number 9, as originally recorded April 27th, 1982, Born in the USA. Live in the studio, and he got this on the third take. He talks about that in his greatest hits package, that this was third take live in the studio, which is kind of impressive because it's just a powerful song. You know, I think Bruce and Max really shine the most on this song. Great drums, you know, killer drums. You got that gated snare, obviously such an 80s drum sound, but, you know, Max is really, you know, kicking some ass on the drums here, and Bruce delivering, I think, one of his best vocal performances ever captured on a record, just belting these lyrics out, you know, addressing, you know, treatment of Vietnam vets. And I love the dichotomy between the verse and the chorus, how he's kind of laying out his anguish in the verse, but then in the chorus he's kind of just triumphantly yelling, yeah, I'm still born in the USA, and you get that sort of back and forth, right? The passion and the conviction of the vocal is kind of just what shines through to me, you know? Like, this would be, I think, a very difficult karaoke song to pull off, you know, properly. right. So Joe, what do you think of this one?
I think it's a brilliantly written song, you know, especially with it's talking to the economy, it's talking about, and very misunderstood. I agree with you, the vocal take is pretty impressive. It's just full of, like, anguish and rawness. But that said, I think, you know, as good as the keyboards are, I think nowadays they sound really dated. Not so much then, but that synth keyboard sound, it sounds really dated now. And for whatever reason, I've never liked this song.
Really?
It's, you know, yeah, I mean, I can appreciate it, but personally, something about it just doesn't gel with me. It just rubs me wrong. I don't know what it is,
right?
You know, but I can respect it, I can appreciate it, but it's just not one of my favorite tracks on this album. Never has been.
I hear you. I had a phase where I kind of got tired of it and I was like, yeah, the keyboards ruin it. But, you know, lately, and
yeah,
you know, as I've been doing this podcast the last, you know, 4 or 5 years, I'm really digging into Springsteen. I've really enjoyed this one a lot more in recent years. What about you, BJ?
One thing I've realized more and more over the years is how often Springsteen started with the lyrics, and then through trial and error and jamming with the band, they would figure out how to turn the lyrics into a song.
Yeah.
And that's a very different take on songwriting, and usually it doesn't result in the best songs. You know, I think the best written songs start with the music and then a melody to match with the music. You can write a good song starting with the lyrics, but Springsteen does it a lot, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we know that because you hear so many different versions of the same lyrics as different songs. And we know that's what happened with this song, is he had these lyrics and they eventually ended up with this. And it works because he has such a knack for melody and he puts so much, like, passion and emotion into it. And he has such incredibly talented musicians that could just go with the flow.
Yeah.
And they can bash this kind of stuff out. But, you know, I said when we did that round table, that big round table we did, Lee, with Greg Troyan and Eric Miller, I said this song, the misinterpretation of the theme and the message of this song is emblematic of why those Nebraska songs didn't work with the band, because this is a perfect example. When he did the song with the band, the message of the song was lost, you know?
Right.
So the song actually didn't translate to a full band version like this, a song with a catchy melody and everything. It actually failed insofar as people didn't understand what the song was about, you know, because of the, I don't know, the energy of it and the, you know, it's got a catchy melody.
Right.
Because Bruce could just jam with the band and bash out a catchy melody. I mean,
and it would be cool. Know,
that's how talented they all are, is that Bruce just starts singing these lyrics and they just start playing and then they end up with this. It's a crazy way to do it, but yeah. He did it a lot, it seems.
And the misinterpretation went all the way to the White House, right? Like Reagan used it as a campaign thing. Right? It's just nuts, you know?
Mm-hmm. But it's also, you know, you put the American flag on your album cover and everything, and it's, you know, USA, USA. That's how it comes across.
Right, I got you.
But, I like this song. But, yes, of course, the synthesizers, you know, it was a bad choice in retrospect. But at the time, that's what, you know, how everything sounded.
Yeah,
so
it worked then.
Yeah.
What about you, John, your thoughts on this song?
Well, the synthesizers don't bother me at all. I think this is like one of the anthems to end all anthems. What you were saying, BJ, I wonder what the perception of this song would be if the cover of this album were him like kicking a can down Skid Row, or, you know, sitting on some cardboard boxes with homeless people or whatever.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like whatever the true nature of this song was, if that was depicted on the album cover, if people would have gotten the message a little bit better, because that is, as it is, the cover looks like he's, you know, just coming home from the Ford plant in Flint, Michigan, or whatever it is, you know, something like that.
Yeah.
Anyway, I agree a little bit with Joe in that, you know, this song, it's too on the nose, I guess, to use a, you know, what the things people are saying these days. It's like it's trying a little too hard to be the anthem that it is. And it is an anthem, but it, because it's only an anthem, you don't put on Born in the USA for any other reason. You don't put it on because it's like, oh yeah, I love that song. But, you know, it's not like, you're not gonna, I don't know. You put it on.
I agree. I know what you mean. Yeah.
Yeah. It's, there's no passive listening to Born in the USA. It's either all or nothing. And so it's just a matter of, am I in the mood to, you know, be that patriotic or whatever? Well, you know, am I in the mood to be that anthemic? I'm not right now, so I'm not going to listen to Born in the USA right now. There's no subtlety to it, I guess is what I'm saying. But I have no problem with the synthesizers. I think it's probably the anthem of the decade, if not one of the biggest anthems of all time. It's just that it's only an anthem and not a song with, like, layers or shade.
Right, right. I do love the drone of the two chords, just back and forth between those two chords, like no bridge, like no difference between the verse and the chorus. I think that's, I know a lot of people criticize them for the being basic like that, but I love it. I love it, you know. And before we move on, just one little quick little note here is director Paul Schrader had this as a title for a film, right? And this is where Bruce got the title. He saw a script, and this was the title of the movie, so he kind of stole the title and put the song out. And then later, that movie became Light of Day, right? So, the trade-off was that Bruce wrote the title song for that movie, which changed the title because Bruce had stole the title, right, for this song.
Interesting.
And then I think he incorporated Born on the 4th of July.
Correct, yeah.
I think that's where he gets the idea of the Vietnam veteran.
Correct, yeah.
So, you know, he kind of stole the title and incorporated the concept, and it, you know, goes back to that Born, you know, the keyword. Mm-hmm. So,
because he's kind of like, I'm going to steal your title, but here's this other song you can have.
Why would you call it Born in the USA? the Joan Jett, Michael J. Fox movie.
Well, I guess it's an American story of a family, you know, working class family kind of thing. Who knows? Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. All right, so we'll go on to track two. Second song on side one is the second single, and there was no video for this. This was released July 31st, 1984, went to number 7, Cover Me.
This is a really great rocker, some great guitar work from Bruce on this one, especially the solo. Love it. I always love it when Bruce tears it up lead guitar solo, and he's really good in this one. Definitely one of my favorite tracks on this album, too.
Yeah, I agree. I like this song a lot, and I was thinking about it to get ready. I think the reason is because I'm not as sick of it as I am so many of the others.
Right.
You know, I'll be honest, playing this album to talk to you was the first time I pulled it out in a long time, because so many of these songs I've never forgotten them. They've never completely gone away. And so there's not like, it doesn't feel like there's nooks and crannies or corners to, you know, to find anew and learn new things about this album. It's kind of like, well, I already know what that is. I know everything on there. There's no surprises, but Cover Me is one of the songs that to me stands up really well. And it's, you know, there's a slight kind of like Latin cha-cha vibe to it or something like that.
Tango to it or something, you know?
That's what I was just going to say. You can imagine someone doing the tango to it. But I think it's because it hasn't been as overplayed as all the others. And that's why I don't mind it. And with there not being a video, it sort of gets lost and forgotten about, you know? Right.
And this song was kind of written for, I think I always get this story mixed up. Like, he wrote this song for Donna Summer, and John Landau said, no, you got to keep that one. So then he gave Donna Summer Protection, which is another similar, that's an outtake, but it was a similar vibe on that song, right? So I think that's what happened. Landa was like, no, you got to keep this one. This is a good one, right? Like you said, Joe, great guitar work on this one. Just Springsteen ripping on the end of this one. It's about a guy kind of desperately seeking salvation and a lover, right? Someone to hold him in their arms, you know? Good four to the floor dance groove. You know, it lends itself to a remix. You know, they did a couple of weird remixes for like three songs off this record, Arthur Baker things, right? So, and then they're not very good, but you know, this one lends itself to that. You could hear it cranking in a club in 1984. You know, and I do love the little end stuff there where it's he's doing his improv stuff, like come on baby, come on now. And like Max is catching him with these like off like drum like smacks on the offbeats and stuff, and the guitar over top of it. I dig this one, pretty cool.
I don't really like it, but I can't really explain why. It's good songwriting. I think John Landa was wrong, because I think this does sound like Bruce wrote it for someone else, not for himself.
Right.
And so that's part of why it doesn't work to me. I don't like the vibe and the lyrics of the song, and I think it doesn't feel like a Bruce Springsteen song, because it's not. He wrote this. He was trying to write something different than what he would write for himself purposely. And so I think that's how it comes across, honestly.
All right. I would say it's one of the most rocking songs on the record, though. Like, if you're going to, like...
Yeah.
That's unfortunate.
Mm-hmm. Crank one really loud and get some rocking guitar, this would be the one, you know? All right, let's go on to song number three on the record. Recorded spring 1982 at the power station in New York City, Darlington County.
I don't hate this song, but it's kind of a throwaway Springsteen song. This is the kind of song, you know, he could do in his sleep, and it sounds so incredibly similar to so many other songs.
I had the same thing written in my notes.
Yeah, this should have been on Tracks. This should have been an outtake that ended up on Tracks. That would be my opinion of this song.
Yeah, so when I was listening to this album, I was thinking this is one of the most important albums. It probably is the most important album of his career, and it's the one that cements so much of what Bruce does as caricature, because he draws from the same small town well in every song. And it becomes a cliche. This song, I think, is the most... This is what a cover band doing cliche versions of Bruce would do, is write a song like Darlington County with the whole kind of, he sings in almost like an affectation, kind of like John Fogerty did in CCR, that making up his own kind of words. And it's just, it falls too far into parody to me. This is what the Lonely Island would do if they were making fun of doing a parody of a Bruce Springsteen song. They would come up with Darlington County.
right.
I don't dislike it. I mean, it's fun.
Yeah.
I love Lee. It's like, serious. All right.
That's just your opinion, man. Like, that's your opinion, man.
Yes. Yeah.
What's your opinion there, Joe?
Well, even like By the Numbers, Springsteen is still pretty much better than a lot of other bands. Yeah, it's like John was saying, the affectation in his vocals is a little too hickish. It's just a little too over the top, maybe. And I totally agree with John saying kind of about the caricature of a Bruce Springsteen song. I mean, I don't hate it. It's not a bad song, but it just is. It's not one of the best songs on the album, and it's good, but it is a little paint by numbers for like Springsteen. Like you've heard, it's like you feel like you've heard this song before on some of his other albums. It's just a different,
It's Cadillac Ranch with different lyrics. I mean,
it's a lot different than that, man.
But I like Cadillac Ranch better. You know, I mean, come on.
I dig this one. I don't have a problem with this song at all. I don't have a problem with any song on this record at all, actually. I dig Little Steven's got some raw background vocals on this, like sounding really harsh.
Yeah.
Like he just drank a bottle of nails or something like that. A lot of attitude in the background vocals. You know, I love the groove in G. You know, he would play this live and, you know, sometimes he would do a little bit of Honky Tonk Women off the start because it's, got that kind of groove to it. I love the sha-la-las. It makes me want to kind of dance with a girl, like, you know, grab her from behind and kind of put your hands on her hips and kind of sway her back and forth. And it's got that like nice little medium groove, you know. Big man play that saxophone, right? We get the first clarinet solo of the record. And, you know, he's used sporadically.
Yeah, the sax was nice.
When he's used, he's used the right way, right? So the sax really picks this song up. And, you know, just a little bit about the lyrics. This is a little story song about, you know, two buddies looking for work on the county line that, you know, the Wayne's uncle hook them up with these jobs, so they're driving down, and on the way they're picking up chicks, you know, listening to tunes, having a good old time. They got $200 to blow, right? They're gonna rock and roll all night, right? And you know, but then there's a third verse twist, right? The Springsteen third verse twist. So like the verse goes on. The verse starts with like Springsteen's looking at this girl in the window, and he's like, I haven't seen my buddy Wayne in 7 days. I don't know what happened. Like he's up to no good, right? So he's just like, he got arrested for something. The cops have got him tied to a bumper. So this guy's just going to take off with the girl. But, yeah, I always wondered, what did Wayne do between that that second and third verse to land him handcuffed to a bumper?
But aren't most Springsteen songs about some variation of the story you just told?
Yeah, that's the brilliance of it, right? Yeah, it's all just people stories, man. It's life.
It is. I mean, he's a
slice of life, man. It's a slice of life. Characters, right?
Yeah.
Well, another thing is the song is 2 minutes too long. It's 4:48. I mean, that's for this song. That's ridiculous.
You need some time to sha la la.
It out live.
You need a good 90 seconds to sha la la. Come on. All right, let's go to song 4 on side 1. This was recorded May 6, 1982 at the power station, Working on the Highway.
Well, this one just solidifies everything I said on the last song. It's another one that's kind of more of a Springsteen cliche than it is like a real song. It's good. Again, I'm not saying I don't like any of these. I loved this album too. It's just that it's hard to take seriously at this point because the earnestness and the Springsteen-ness of it is so heavy. this is another perfect example. I sort of feel like this song would play in the background of a, I don't know, of like a Disney movie or something like that. It's
Disney movie.
Kind of, yeah. It's got, or maybe, you know, one of my favorite movies of the 80s is Gung Ho, that Michael Keaton one, where he works in an auto plant. I could see this like playing in the background of the montage in Gung Ho. Anyway,
Don't Get Me Wrong. Don't Get Me Wrong is in that movie.
And Tough Enough by Fabulous Thunderbirds.
One of the greatest.
Worst shit ever.
I'm not talking about anything else they did, but Tough Enough is killer.
It is.
And it's perfect in that movie.
Oh, my God.
I don't think this song would work for Disney though. Like that, this song, these lyrics are definitely like adult.
No, I kind of know what he means. Like this could have been, this song could have been sung by the Doozers on Fraggle Rock while they were at work. Or something.
Man, what's wrong with that? That's good, man. I love this song.
I love Fraggle Rock.
This has got a good rockabilly groove to this, right? And the lyrics is about a guy, you know, a working class guy. He's working on the road. Right? He's like a road worker, and he's saving up his money for his little girl, right? And then he's like. And he's another victim of the female species, right? Like this young succubus, right? Like, so he goes to visit her dad and, like, tell him his intentions, right? And his dad doesn't like him, so he boots him out, right? And then he takes her from Stouffville, Mississippi, all the way to Florida, right? His heart is just beaming. He's just like, let's just get out of Mississippi. I'm going to take you to Florida, right? And then one day the brothers came and got her, right? And put him in black and white. So our protagonist is, like, this blue-collar guy, and now he's doing time working on the road line, working on the... the Charlotte County Road Line, right? So, using, kind of that Southern street vernacular to shape the lyrics, telling all the character story. I'd always dug the train beat on this one. Like, let me grab my guitar here. Like, I always loved rockabilly music, right? So when I heard this song come on, I'm like, oh, it's like Springsteen doing rockabilly, right? And I love the little guitar lick. Right, that stuff was all cool, right? So it just makes me want to. It's just a good, fun little rockin' tune, right? A little levity with Darlington County, like a little back to back, a little levity there, right? And the acoustic guitar mixed with the low string, little rockabilly stuff doing the little licks there. Right?
I like listening to you play this song better than the actual song.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it's the rockabilly aspect that saves this song. Like, sort of like what John was saying about, like, his complaints about the last song, and you kind of go into this. There's the same sort of thing. He's singing an affectation. It's kind of hickish, but it works better than Darlington County does for me. And it's that whole rockabilly rave-up vibe of the song that I like that, at least. So that saves the song for me.
All right, so let's go on to the second last song.
Hey, wait a minute.
Oh, I'm sorry.
You've already heard me enough about this song, right?
Yeah, you got nothing to comment on this, do you, Brian?
Yeah, we did. We did Worst of Springsteen in the 80s with Brian Soren. I think me and Brian both picked this as the worst Springsteen song of the entire 80s.
Oh, you guys are wrong.
Yeah, but this is another one where he started with the lyrics. Because this was a very different song called Child Bride, which was a slow acoustic song, very dark.
Yeah.
And then he turned it into this with the same exact lyrics. So, but I'll get into it later. But the sequencing on this record is baffling. And what, in my opinion, what we have here after the opening song, we have the three worst songs on the album right in a row, which is insane. And then we get a masterpiece is buried on the second side, so we'll get to that. But the sequencing of the record is nuts. I have no idea what's going on.
I like this little like moment in the record where it starts off like heavy with Born in the USA and Cover Me, and then into a little levity, and then we're gonna go in a bit of a darker place to finish the record here, right? So let's carry on with the fourth song. And this was recorded May 6, 1982. One of my favorites, Downbound Train.
Times got hard.
song was almost included on the Nebraska record. There's a band session of the Nebraska record, and this was part of that. He didn't use it then, and he reworked it for this album. We get into some darkness, like I said. You know, a lot of melancholy on this. It's about a guy missing a lover, right? He's dreaming of her. He gets the realization that she's really gone, right? Like, there's that great breakdown third verse where he hears the whistle whine, right? And he drops to his knees, and he hangs his head, and he cries because he realizes, like, hey, he's awakening from this dream, right? And, you know, I always thought that was like a little reference to, like, Folsom Prison by Johnny Cash, right? When he's like, when I hear that whistle blowing, I hang my head and cry, right? A little bit of the same lyrical influence there, right? And the best line is, I work down at the car wash where all it ever does is rain.
Rain.
Right, talk about, you know, painting a picture. Right, and he ends the song like where he's swinging a hammer on a railroad gang, and he's got this girl still stuck in his head, right? And it just keeps bringing him down like he's riding on this downbound train.
I really like this song a lot, even though lyrically it falls under all the same cliches everything else does, if not more so. If not more so, but...
What do you mean by a cliche, though? Like, what's a cliche?
Every song we've talked about, it has the same idea to it.
But that's the theme of the record. The theme of the record is about your hopes going wrong, like economy bringing your dreams down to reality and things like that, right? So that's what every song has got that theme running through it, and that's why these songs made the record.
I agree. The issue is that every Bruce Springsteen song has these same ideas to them. It would be nice if there was a little bit more diversity in there.
The cliche that John's talking about is what John Bon Jovi has made a career on.
True. That's true. And
we're taking a weird direction on this episode here now.
Bruce, your favorite, I referenced your favorite drummer just now.
That's true.
Yeah.
No, Bruce is one of my favorite artists, but I wish that he could expand beyond his palette. He kind of goes back to the same well. Anyway, having said all that, this is one of my favorite songs on the album, and I really love the vibe. I love that it's a little darker. I love that he allows himself to go dark on this one. I was not a fan of the Nebraska album other than Atlantic City, so this is pleasant... I know. I'm different that way, but I like him going this dark on this album. It's a nice counterbalance.
Cool. I don't mind the keyboard sound on it either. I think it kind of works.
No.
The kind of dark minor synth patch. What about you, Joe?
I love this song. This is like, from the first time I heard it, this has always been one of the songs that stands out to me. Like you said, it's haunting. It's melancholy. I also had that same line written down. Like, here's this poor sad sappy. Just can't catch a break no matter what he's doing.
Yeah.
You know, he works three different jobs in this song, you know. But just the musical atmosphere matched with the vocal delivery and stuff, it's just always stuck with me. And I remember like we were talking about how this album like went into super popular in 1985. Girl I'd been dating for like 6 or 7 months, and I broke up, and like this was like the song that got me through that. Yeah. You know, I would just fall back on this tune, and it would like, it is sad, and as heartbroken as I was, it just kind of gave me some respite, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love this song. This is another one that started with the lyrics, though. We know that there's different permutations of the same lyrics. He tried them in different ways. Yeah. And I would love to hear the first try that the band did on this song, you know, when he was during those Nebraska sessions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, you know, they through trial and error, they end up here. I'm just such a sucker for Springsteen's melodies and the way somehow he injects emotion into it that translates to me. Like, I think about, if I were to read the lyrics to Tougher Than the Rest, I would think they were stupid, but that song can make me cry because of the way he sings it and the melody of it and the emotion of the song that I'm just a sucker for it. So this is an example of, yeah, this is so effective for whatever reason. And
Plus, I should add in the lyrics too, like one of the lyrics is the guy's name is Joe. So we all got to be for that too, you know?
Yeah. All right, so let's finish off side one with a smoldering song. This was the fourth single off the record, released February 6, 85, went to number six, recorded May 11th, 1982, I'm on Fire.
Again, this is like one of my favorite tracks on the album. It just flows perfectly out of Downbound Train. It's sparse and simple in the arrangement, which helps make it work so well. I love the line in it. I think probably everybody can relate to this, where it's like sometimes it's like someone took a Night Baby Edgy and Dull and cut a 6-inch valley through the middle of my soul. Yeah. I mean, that.
I always misheard that as skull, right?
Yeah, I was going to say the exact same thing. I always thought he said skull.
Yeah.
Yep.
Both rhyme. Like, both work. Both work.
To me, it's like perfect 1-2 punch on this album. Like, I love both these songs equally. And just it's just like so good.
Yeah, like I said, continuing that dark vibe, nice sequenced after a Downbound Train. You know, there's tension in the muted guitar, right? And there's in that drum groove, right? Max is playing Brush on the Snare with that cross stick, right? And it's like smoldering like a sexual desire, right? A lot of sexual tension in this song. And another good use
of the... And it's still got that kind of train thing going on with the guitar.
Well, yeah, it's like a Johnny Cash influence, right? Like, this song was influenced by Johnny Cash. You did a cover of it around 2000, I think, you know? And, you know, I don't mind the synth sound on this. It's not bad. It gives you that sort of dark vibe to it. And I like the separation, the stereo separation, too, where we have drums on one side and guitar on the other side.
Yeah.
You know, and... You know, it's a quick little 2.5-minute song. Like, it was a single, right? So just a 2.5-minute single, which is kind of fun, nice, right? And you know what? Chicks love this song, right? So when I play this, the song is panty dropper for sure. You know, chicks dig this one. I love the falsettos at the end.
Oh, this is a beautiful, brilliant song. It's hilarious. When I was taking notes for this, I was listening to this song and I was thinking, because I keep talking about how he started with the lyrics. And with this song, I was thinking, this feels like a fully arranged song, like fully written, like, you know, this didn't start with the lyrics. And then I'm looking at Wikipedia and this started with the lyrics.
Yeah.
It says that this took place in an impromptu fashion when Springsteen started making up a slow tune on guitar for some lyrics he had, some of which had been written for Spanish Eyes, which would later surface on The Promise. So he can create something this amazing in that way of just jamming with the guys in the studio with some lyrics he has. That's insane. Yeah. This song is so brilliant. This song is way too short. Darlington County should be 240, and this should be 440. That's what I will say.
I do love it because it's such an economical. What's that word?
Economical.
Yeah, it's
way too soon.
Yeah, it's an economical use of it. Yeah,
it's so good. It shouldn't end.
Yeah, exactly. I should. That's one thing I forgot to write in my notes was that like. It doesn't overstay its welcome, but you want it to. You want this song to keep going on.
You got to pick it up and drop the needle again. What about you, John? What are your thoughts on this one?
It's so interesting. I'm glad to hear everyone likes this song because I do too. But it's funny because I remember when this came out and I hated this song.
It was a little too cliched, right? Too many cliches in this.
It's so different. You've heard like 3 or 4 huge poppy rock anthems in a row, and then this weird little thing comes out, and you're right, it's 2.5 minutes, and the video is longer because it's got the whole intro of him like sliding, you know, he's been working on the car.
Is it Christie Brinkley that's in the video?
It doesn't even show the face of the woman. She comes right. in to get her car fixed.
Oh, and I'm thinking of the Billy Joel video.
Uptown right. Girl, yeah, yeah.
So it's, I've always thought of this song because the kid, the 11-year-old me, didn't get it at all. But the grown-up me, the mature me, gets it completely. And so I love it now. I'm curious if you guys loved it back then because it it was so slow and different comparatively that I just thought it was boring. I didn't get it at all.
I dug it. Oh,
I, did. I think I did like it. I've always liked songs like this, like With or Without You.
Yeah.
Don't You Forget About Me, like songs with the, yeah. I love to listen to a song and just get so depressed and miserable and sad, you know.
I did too, but this one didn't do it for me. It was more boring than anything else, but now I absolutely get it.
Yeah.
My mom, who like also, like she, my mom had two people who she thought were like hot guys. One of them was Paul Stanley and the other one was Bruce Springsteen. And she loved this song.
Yeah,
so, shout out to my mom, my dear departed mom on Mother's Day. But yeah, she loved this song.
Like, yeah,
and that little chord change from the major to the minor, the C to the A minor. I always loved that little chord change. I always thought that was cool. So that's side one. Hope you enjoyed that. Thanks again to Joe, BJ, and John. Stay tuned. Side two coming soon. I'll leave you with this great live performance of Cover Me from Queen Elizabeth Olympic Park in London, England, June 30th, 2013. At the gig, Bruce and the E Street Band performed the entire Born in the USA album for the crowd, in sequence. It was a killer performance, which was recorded and released. You know, I grabbed this as a bonus DVD with the High Hopes record in 2014. You know, I love the guitar playing on this track, Cover Me. You know, Bruce calls out to Steven Van Zandt at the end to take the outro solo, and Miami Steve delivers. Towards the end of Steven's solo, Bruce joins him for some blazing dual lead guitar playing. It's cool to watch Bruce's reaction to Steve's guitar playing. They're really jamming on this stage on this song. Awesome. Bruce gives him an approving brotherly punch on the shoulder at the end. So awesome. Turn it up. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next time.
1, 2. We'll cover me. The show, folks. Thanks for listening. You can find us on our website at trampslikeuspod.com, communicate with us on Facebook at our Tramps Like Us podcast group page, and on Twitter at Tramps Like Us Pod. Don't forget to subscribe to the show on iTunes, where you can leave a review and a 5-star rating. Tramps Like Us podcast is a non-profit audio fanzine created by fans for fans and is available for free. We are not affiliated with Bruce Springsteen or Columbia Sony Records. If you've heard any music you like, please find it and purchase it from brucespringsteen.net, iTunes, Amazon, your local record store, or wherever music is sold. As always, gratitude and respect to Bruce Springsteen and all past and current members of the heart-stopping, pants-dropping, hard-rocking, booty-shaking, earthquaking, love-making, Viagra-taking, history-making, testifying, death-defying, legendary, E Street Band.
Man. Hey, I'm a Cancer with a bad moon.
Right here, El Fago. Watch my lips. Where were you born?
I was born in East L.A., man. I was born in East L.A.
Oh, yeah, you're born in East L.A. Well, let's see your green card, huh?
Green card? I'm from East L.A.
All right, well, then who's president of the United States?
Oh, that's easy, man. That guy that used to be on Death Valley days, John Wayne.
All right, let's go. Come on.